the top players and legends to the very best analysts around the world from wherever the beautiful game is played. This is BTP. Now, we're talking football.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Beyond the Pitch. And today I have the pleasure of speaking to a great, and of course, he's very busy with his new book, Life in a Jungle, my autobiography, none other than the great Bruce Grubler. How are you, sir? How's everything going over there?
Not bad at all. Thank you very much indeed for allowing me to come onto your podcast.
Perfect, Bruce. And Bruce, the first question that always intrigued me, and even more so after reading your book, was there one decision that you can really attribute to you really making the jump to football or even making the path to football that much more accessible? Was there one moment where you said, okay, I'm doing this as a footballer? Was there one moment that really set that off, or was it just a series of events that occurred early on in your life?
I think it was a series of events that occurred in my young life living in Africa. One, I played all the sports, so therefore I played three sports for my country. That was cricket and baseball. And because I was playing cricket at a very high level for my country as a wicketkeeper, it changed when the coach from a senior side came and asked me if I would like to become a goalkeeper. So I went, and I was a goalkeeper there at Salisbury Kallies. I signed my first contract there. Salisbury Kallies.
Yeah,
and that was the when I realized that football is a very well paid sport. So I said to my mother, I wanted to become a goalkeeper.
Were there any quality? He said you have to be a goalkeeper because you have this or that quality, or was it that he saw you before? Or what was that?
No. He was sitting on the side of the road watching me play, messing about in a goal at my old school. So I just went, and that was it. That was how it was.
Bruce, and this was about how old were you at this time?
I was 14 years of age.
14 years of age. Wow. I mean,
yes.
And how were the logistics? I mean, obviously playing in Africa, how was it when you, let's say, moved on to the national team level, or the international level, if you will, and you were representing, you know, your country at that time? How have you seen the logistics change in terms of the way that you had to go about compared to how players in that region of the world go about? How different is it now, or has it changed much?
Well, it's changed, of course. Mm-hmm. When I played for my country, right up until the 89, the logistics was I had to get the logistics. I had to find out where I was going to go to get to for my next game. For instance, we played one game at Anfield. I had to fly to London Gatwick to jump on the Air Zimbabwe flight to fly to Harare, get there on Sunday morning, go to sleep for 3 hours, and then get up and then go to the game and play the game in the afternoon. When we finished the game in the afternoon after there in the National Sports Stadium, get in a car to take me to the airport and jump on the plane to come back. That's the logistics of it. And it's changed now because, of course, you have international breaks, so your team don't play over the weekends, which would have made my job, my logistics, much easier. Mm-hmm. But as it happened, it didn't, and I had to go with that.
You made it sound so easy, so simple. I mean, especially what you went through as far as having to get everything done, and this was pretty much every single time that you were going through, which makes it even more amazing.
That's right, and also away from home in Africa, you have to. One time I came back from Togo,
yeah.
So Togo is in West Africa. I had to fly to Ghana to London Heathrow to Liverpool. So that's how I did it that time.
Wow. In your book that just came out recently, you talked about how football saved you as far as you were concerned. I'm asking more in a rhetorical fashion. How did it save you? I mean, especially you having come out recently from the Army to go into football. How did it save you?
Well, any person that goes into combat and sees the things that I've seen, and if you go around the world, that people go into shelters because of the trauma that they've seen. It's called PTSD. And so I know for a fact that if I hadn't had football, I might have been in the same position where they just want to block out all the memories of what happened. So football for me kept my mind off that, thinking about those tragedies that happened and the horrific things that happened. So football saved me because I was concentrating every single day on my job. And to get paid and live a new day was the best thing in the world. You're getting paid for something that you enjoy doing, plus you enjoy your sport, and you can smile. And I had a smile on my face all the time. That is what I meant, that football saved me. Had football not been there, I don't think I'd be in the same position I am today.
Because I remember now that you mentioned this, I used to work with one of your former teammates, with Steve Nichol, and he would always tell me that, or he'd tell all of us, Bruce always had a smile on his face. He was always a very happy-go-lucky, very, appreciative of life type of individual. So that's what made you such a character, such a great individual to play and to, add such color to the sport. It definitely gave you a different perspective as concerned. And now you look at the horrors of what, you went through it. And of course, it makes you much more supportive of everyone that goes through those types of situations, whether it was back when you were in the military or even now, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, you have a look at everything in the life of an army personnel who has come out of an area that is what we call hot. And anybody that's been in a hot area will come out with some trauma. And it's proven, and doctors have identified it, that it's post-traumatic distress order, PTSD.
Bruce, and after that, of course, you end up taking a very, I guess, not the shortest path between two points, if you will. You end up going from that situation to Canada, to England. What made you go, first of all, to Vancouver and then to England? It was kind of confusing there. I mean, if you look at the career, usually sometimes nowadays you look at it from that perspective of going the other way around. But, was it you just trying to get away from everything that was going on and all of a sudden falling into the situation at Liverpool? Or how did that work for you as far as mindset was concerned?
My mindset was I wanted to become a Liverpool goalkeeper, and my first port of call was West Bromwich Albion was my first port of call. They gave me my first opportunity here in Britain, but I couldn't get a work permit.
And that leads you to Canada, or how did that work out?
Well, what happened there was that I couldn't get a work permit, and when I came back to West Brom and I said I'm going back home, he said, "No, go take yourself to Derby County because Tony Waiters from Vancouver wants a goalkeeper in Canada. So take yourself to there, train, and let's see what you can do." So I went there, trained, and he signed me. So I was fortunate to get to Vancouver at that time. Mm-hmm. Then whilst I was in Vancouver, end of the Vancouver season, he said to me that the manager, Tony Waiters, said, "I'm sending you to Crewe Alexandra to see if you can play in the English League."
Yeah.
And that is when the country changed from Rhodesia to Zimbabwe, and I got a Zimbabwe passport, and I played for Zimbabwe in the World Cup, which made it a little easier because now Zimbabwe was part of the Commonwealth, where South Africa was banned. So that is how the work permit came about.
As you said before, a lot of different things that had to occur for that to happen. But of course, fortunately, we have the pleasure. Well, tell me, when you get to Liverpool and you start to deal with the personalities that you had to play with, the Steve Nichols, Steve McMahons, Ian Rush, I mean, all these individuals you play with, and you go into that dressing room for the first time, some personalities are already there, some might not be what they ended up being. How were you treated? How were you looked at in that dressing room and that first instance? Obviously, we know how things did play out.
Well, when I first went to Liverpool, then you usually go into the first team dressing room or the away team dressing room at Anfield. Mm-hmm. That's where we dressed. But when I came to Anfield, I was never put in the away dressing room. Mm-hmm. They came and brought me into the main dressing room, and I sat in the main dressing room from day one.
Yeah.
So, and I now know why, because the coaches at the time wanted me to get integrated with the first team and to get the mindset straight away. I think that they knew that that Ray Clements was going to be going, and that's how they did it.
Was there anything that they saw that they said, hey, we got to do this? Or is it just, you know, was it just a unique situation? Was your situation, I mean, was it a unique one compared to what was going on with other players in that situation? Or they just said, hey, you know what? This guy's different. We have to be able to put him in as quickly as possible.
Well, I don't know. It took, from what I've heard, that it took mm-hmm. them a long time to talk to the Home Office and to the FA to get me permission to come there to Anfield in the first place. So they thought, well, if we've taken this much time, maybe we should just groom him as if he is going to be a first teamer. And that's why I stayed in the first team dressing room, and which kind of. Mm-hmm. I'm very proud of the fact that they did that for me. Mm-hmm. Also, to they saw me at Portsmouth away, second last game when I played for Crewe. Mm-hmm. Only one person, that was Tom Saunders, and he said, "Forget about the midfielder. Have a look at this goalkeeper." And then the next game, I went out there, and I was the captain of the day. They watched the warm up only. And then left to watch Stoke City play Port Vale. So they were interested in just in seeing how I was in the warm-up. You must understand that Liverpool followed me for 2 months prior to them coming to watch me play there. I had a person follow me every single day to see what I ate, see when I went out, see when I went to sleep. 2 days before the game, what was he doing? The night before game, what was he doing? And then that report went back to Anfield. So it went through a long process.
That's truly, I mean, that's interesting to hear, because, I mean, was there something that they said, well, I'm not so sure, we have to be 100% sure with this guy? I mean, why so much of a following, I mean, compared to other players, past or present, but was there a reasoning behind that? I do not know.
I know the person that actually followed me. His name is Mr. Peter D. He was a scout for Liverpool, and they put him on to me from Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. He came to Crewe, and he followed me around from Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, every single week for about a month. And I thought, you know, what's this fella doing here? You know, when I went to the cafe down the road, he followed me and seen where I was eating, and then I found him in another pub, and then on the Wednesday when I went into one of the discos there, he was sitting in the corner, so I quickly left.
Oh, but we're here with Bruce Grubler on Beyond the Pitch, and Bruce, when you were finally given that opportunity, that first opportunity at Liverpool on the pitch, I mean, what was going through your mind? Tell me a little bit about that process that was going through your mind, also within the team and the players.
Well, we come back in for the 81-82 season, and Ray Clements has left. So we are going on a pre-season tour. We've done our hard training at Anfield. We're going on our pre-season tour, and they start to play me straight away. So I played every single pre-season game, and I had a sense that I was going to be thrown in the deep end, which happened at Wolverhampton Wanderers, our very first game of the season. We lost 1-0, and then we beat Arsenal at home 3-1. So we started off badly, but then we picked up, and then we went on. And for the first 6 months, there were mistakes that I made. I got Liverpool knocked out of the European Cup by a mistake in Sofia, so it wasn't good for myself. Then at Boxing Day, I made a few mistakes. We lost 3-1 to Manchester City at home. So, you know, there was things that I needed to sort out in my head. And Bob Paisley was the one that actually sorted it out. He just said, how do you think you've played for the first 6 months? I said, well, maybe I could have played better and maybe I should stop walking on my hands or swinging on the crossbar. So he said, yes, if you don't, you'll find yourself back at Crewe, which meant that was a big flag for me. And so I went out of the dressing room and they changed. They made a change the next game. They took the captaincy of Phil Thompson and gave it to Graham Souness. And we went on and I think that we lost one game in the second half of that season and we rattled up a record 24 points. And so we won the league with a game to spare by 3 points. And that was when the league was 2 points for a win and one for a draw. So we did our very best and we picked up two trophies in my first year.
Not bad to start out. Not bad at all. And it's interesting that you mentioned that those moments in that particular season, because it kind of reflects to the vision of the manager saying, you know, let's give him a chance. Let's let him understand what he did wrong, what he did right, and let, you know, the goalkeeper himself analyze it. Something that we haven't been able to see in certain situations. And you've been very vocal about it recently, especially in the case of Lawrence Karius, that you came out and said, hey, you know what? His confidence was shot to a certain extent. Yeah. And people don't understand how fragile, yet how sturdy the mentality of the goalkeeper has to be, because any little mistake, he's the one that has the mistakes pretty much stand out the most.
Oh, absolutely. Goalkeepers are a unique position because they're not going to remember the 3 or 4 saves that you did in the game. They're going to remember the goal that you let in. That's just part and parcel of being a goalkeeper. And that's where you have to be very, very strong and you have a very thick skin like a rhino.
And you've been in both positions too. You've been as the goalkeeper, but you've also been a goalkeeping coach, you know, in different places, you know, one of them most recently in Canada. How do you as the goalkeeping coach come in and get into the player's head? I mean, that's a very important part of that role specifically. How do you do to say, look, shake it off, keep going, this is what you're doing wrong, but at the same time, you have to build them up yet again to have them back under the sticks, you know, the next match?
Yeah, with the new technology in matches, every single match is televised. So you go and break down the goals that your goalkeeper lets in and you can analyze it with him. Now, if you do it properly, you can actually say, you never used your feet. This is what we're going to have to work on your feet. So we work on his feet. This is where your positioning was. You were too far back in one. That gave him a bigger angle to shoot in the corner. So with the new technology, it's very easily to analyze. And that's what I did with my players. Had I had Lawrence Karius under my wing, I would have taken him under my wing and I would have said, listen, no problem at all. We sit him down, we see his mistakes and analyze those. And then tell him, this is what you've done wrong, but never mind. We're going to give you another chance and just carry on telling him that he is the best goalkeeper. Because that's what goalkeepers need. Young goalkeepers need to hear that they are the best in the world and they will produce their best if you tell them that. It's not a rocket science that we do here in goalkeeping coaching.
Yeah, of course. I mean, but it's a huge, at times, mental exercise. I mean,
it is. You have to change the mindset of how he is. My goalkeeper in North America came as a 34-year-old, thought he knows everything about Europe and everything, and then I just looked at how many times he played for all his clubs. And the one club, he only played 14 games for it. So I said to him, you telling me that you know everything about Europe. You know nothing about Europe because if you only played 14 games for this team and then 8 games for this team, yes, you'd be there for a long, long time, but you're not the first team choice. You are just sitting on the bench. Now, if you wanted to learn, let's learn. So we broke him down like that. I built him up again, and he became the best goalkeeper in the North American Soccer League. And he still got the record today at 7.5 games without a goal against.
Bruce, what are you seeing in goalkeeping today that has really evolved the game? And who do you see as like the standard bearers right now as far as goalkeepers in the present, as far as, you know, in Europe, in South America, or in North America, wherever you may be observing that those trends the most?
Listen, goalkeepers around in the Premier League, we've got some fine goalkeepers. We've got Lloris, we've got De Gea, we've got Alisson with us. We've got the boy at Man City. These are fine goalkeepers. And, you know, then you look over in Germany, there's brilliant goalkeepers over there. But I wouldn't put Karius out of that either. Have you ever looked at where Karius is now? He's at Besiktas. Besiktas are fourth in the league. That doesn't make him a bad goalkeeper. It makes him one of the best in the league there. So we, you know, it's all about bringing that person and putting arms around that person that's going to make him better as a goalkeeper. So this is what we tried to do with the goalkeepers that we have now.
And which one, I mean, is there a goalkeeper you can say right now is the best in the world? Is there, I mean, what do you think about a goalkeeper like, I mean, you know, you already mentioned Ederson, but someone like Thibaut Courtois or a goalkeeper like Marc-Andre Ter Stegen?
Listen, jeepers, Ter Stegen, brilliant. Courtois, brilliant. Neuer, brilliant. But then you've got Lloris, and then you've got Karius over in Besiktas. Then you've got Alisson and the boy in Man City. They are all very, very good goalkeepers. And then De Gea. So I think that De Gea, for me, epitomizes where he is and how he plays. Because if he wasn't at Man United would be near the bottom of the league.
I agree with that. I do, especially seeing him after yesterday's performance, definitely.
Absolutely.
Bruce, tell me a little bit about the book just to let the audience know. Where can people find you? What are you looking to do as far as promotion of the book? What are you looking to do as far as the continuation of that project?
No, we continue the project. It's already sold out, the first line, so I'm not doing anything that the publishers don't want. It's a book. It's a book that if they read it, it's my time to tell a story. And the people that didn't know me from the beginning and had an opinion on me, well, let them make their opinion after they've read the book. Maybe they'll find that their opinion is right and they don't like me even more. I don't mind. But in the book, I say to everybody that reads the book and who has ever met me or come into contact with me, thank you very much, because you are, I thank everybody in the world that I've met, because otherwise I would not be able to write this book.
Well, I'll tell you this right now. After reading the book, you really became one of those top people that I'd like to meet in person. As far as bucket list of people to meet, you're definitely up top there. I personally enjoy it. I recommend it. And I hope that many other fans, Liverpool or not, there should be individuals that go in and enjoy that book, definitely. Again, Bruce Grubler, it's a pleasure to have you on. I wish I had more time to talk to you. I probably have talked to you for hours and hours on end and just listened to you incessantly. But that's, again, with time available. But thank you so much, and best of luck to you as far as the future is concerned. Thank you so much for being on Beyond the Pitch.
Thank you very much indeed. And Beyond the Pitch, make sure if you ever come to Liverpool, go to a little place called Hotel Tia. It is fine. It's a memorial of Liverpool and memorabilia. And you'll meet some fine people. And then that's where you might meet me. Cheers then. All the very best.
Thank you, sir. Have a good one.
All right.